My name is Harriet Tramer, and good afternoon, and thanks for joining me as I host Reaching for the Gold. I hope you will join me every other Tuesday afternoon at this time when this show is broadcast. My two guests today are both concerned about helping seniors age safely, but their focus is very different. Scott Penwell works to ensure they are safe when they journey online, and as founder of the Pittsburgh-based Center for Aging in Place, Susan Kaplan is concerned about making certain they have a circle of love around them as they age at home. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you talk about aging in place. Yeah. You hear an awful lot about that now, but isn't this simply returning to an older pattern where families lived in three-generation homes and the elders aged in place? How is this anything new?
There is a lot of redefining of what aging in place is. To begin with, it's long since been the case where families stay intact generation to generation. I think 50 years ago when the kids got out of school and started leaving their communities, there no longer was the multi-generational families intact. And so people started aging in their homes with a spouse and often ended up alone and just stayed in those homes. We're now redefining aging in place as not keeping decrepit older people in decrepit older homes, but allowing people to live the best life they can in a downsized or resized environment in a multi-generational community.
What are the advantages of this? You hear a great deal of discussion about it, and your redefinition is interesting and I'm certain pertinent, but is this just something trendy? People throw around a lot of terms. What are the advantages of this? Why has it become so popular?
Well, I think we always, as populations change, redefine the way people live. But I guess there are two benefits to aging in place. One of them is to the community at large. It's a really better way of maintaining financial stability for an aging population. It really, to put people in a constant care situation, is costly, and it also takes away their independence. And that really does take away the quality of life, which is the other long-term benefits. And we really are starting to see the aging of boomers. And boomers themselves are infinitely independent, and they actually are the ones who are encouraging this of their parents. We have an awful lot of people in their 60s who are still, you know, caregiving to parents who were in their 80s and 90s.
That's fascinating to me. Because if you're talking about the boomers, you're talking about a generation that was, I won't say at war with, but that was in conflict, whatever word you choose to use, with an older generation. It's fascinating that they're coming around and doing the best they can to help their aging parents after having some real conflicts with them in many cases.
You know, it's a transition of maturation, and I think that, you know, you define your own personal independence by going to war with those people who helped to raise you, and most of us come full circle to come back and realize that we have to reunite and actually have conversations with our aging parents, because that's a way for us to give extra meaning to our lives.
Now, if you talk about aging in place, somebody being cared for in the home, that's a wonderful idea. But when I think about it, I come up against a stumbling block that makes me say, hey, wait a minute, this might not be for everybody. If you are in certain circumstances whereby you need help, you know, 24 hours a day. Maybe you don't need somebody helping you every 5 minutes, but there needs to be somebody there. You can get that to varying degrees of effectiveness, I'm sure, at a nursing home, sometimes with Medicaid paying for it. If you are aging at home, boy, somebody has to be there. Folks have to work these days. How does that happen? Aren't there great financial barriers to aging at home?
Well, again, you talk about home, but we really encourage people to look at a downsizing relocation option, because too often the home, which could be a house, is something which is hard to take care of, along with taking care of, you know, a parent as well. And I don't assume that everybody who ages in place needs 24/7 care. I mean, a lot of people want their independence. By the way, that's one of the indicators of somebody who really is a candidate for aging in place, and that is that they really value their independence. I think if you have somebody in their 60s who is dependent on the kindness of others, they're not likely to be a good candidate to age in place. And the 24/7 aspect of it, there are two issues around that. One of them is technology is beginning to allow for it not having to be a person. You can actually monitor somebody in place with actually cameras or with, fall alerts and all kinds of things that will allow the caregiver not to have to be in the actual home on a 24/7 basis. And the newest thing is things called co-housing, or actually putting people together in joint homes where they support and take care of each other. And I know of two sisters who are aging in place, and one of them is cognitively impaired at this point, and the other one is physically impaired, and somehow they're able to do what the other one can't do. And there is other family members that look in on them, but they're able to support each other.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful, but not everybody is that fortunate. Would you favor, or does your group favor, having more governmental funds spent on helping people get the assistance they need so they can age in home, possibly even paying a family member to care for them? Do you think that would make a big difference?
Well, actually, that's being done, and actually it varies state by state depending on what the aging program is. You know, we have something in Pennsylvania called Options Care, and a home caregiver actually can receive a stipend for doing some of that. Not certainly one that would support an income that you had. But because the cost of Medicaid nursing care, 62% of all the patients in nursing homes in Pennsylvania are paid for by Medicaid at about $120 a day. And that's not sustainable. So that the agencies are springing up all over that are supporting aging-in-place kinds of things. We have caregivers, home health care offers, case managers, Meals on Wheels, you know, so there's a variety of things, and they're actually getting into the environment to see if they can keep somebody independent longer. So, government resources are limited. I think you need to redeploy them away from, you know, supporting some of the things that you did, and now really providing the at-home care.
Now, what are some signs a family has? I'm going to give you an example. There is the 85-year-old mother and grandmother who has some degree of dementia, but physically has no demanding health problems, medication, doctor's visits, that's about it for her. There are her daughter and her son-in-law, they both work. Grandson off at college. What would be some suggestions or some green lights that this family can, in fact, keep that person in the home? What are some indications that's possible?
I think that there are two things. The first indication that that is possible is if this family has a history of some open communications. Probably the most difficult thing about aging in place when there are generational caregivers, another generation, is that there is not a dividing of the support, so that one sibling has to do more than the other and they resent it and it becomes an issue between them. Families that are more likely to be able to really allow somebody to age in place and do so comfortably are families that are open and collaborate with one another and everybody pitches in. And you know, the last thing particularly a mother wants to see is her children fight. That's certainly not the last words she'd like to hear. So I think that's really critical that people understand that they're going to have to divide up the work. And again, depending on how much the impairment is, there is social technology, and there is a great deal of technology that is available to support somebody in a home to let you know that they're okay when you're not, you know, there. And it's not all just about, you know, help me, I've fallen and I can't get up. So these are some of the issues that you have to think about.
In other words, what you're saying is they're doing good going in. It's going to continue to be a positive matter.
If they start out doing well at the time, you certainly can keep them longer in an environment. But, you know, the reality is you've got to make sure that their environment is scaled to their needs. So that, again, maybe it's a downsize in a smaller environment, a couple of rooms, or, you know, a smaller apartment, and the things that make it safer for them to be around. And, I know people well into their 90s that are living independently and with some support are, you know, thriving. And we really have to look at multiple service modalities to make that happen. And also, we have to support caregivers emotionally. It's important where they don't need the financial support that they're able to get the community support and emotional support for what they're doing, or they feel very isolated and very much confused and don't know what the system, you know, is about. So we really need to do that. Actually, companies report that that's one of their major problems is in absenteeism, is that it's a caregiver who needs to leave, not these days because of a child, but because of the needs of a parent.
Now, okay, there's a few issues to deal with from what you said. First off, everything has its limits. What might be an indication that aging at home for this particular individual has reached its limits? It's no longer feasible. It just cannot happen anymore. What would be indications of that? Or are there no indications? You just have to readapt the living at home environment.
First one is social isolation and what they are doing with themselves. And again, I go back to the technology enablers. You actually can install technology that maps out the floors of an apartment, a house, and you can find out when somebody is not moving around, getting up, and being active during the day. You can find out when they're not eating, not just by checking their food, but by actually measuring how many times they've opened the refrigerator, so that, you know, when you find somebody becoming socially and emotionally isolated, you'll find somebody who's beginning to deteriorate.
I understand, but couldn't some of these measures be viewed as obstructive? Young people, they're growing up with Facebook, they're growing up with selfies, they're growing up with Instagram. They're used to everything being broadcast. Somebody in their 80s isn't. Won't they have a hard time adapting to that type of technology?
You know, I think that people who were in their 80s, interestingly enough, are not as foreign to, I mean, it depends. I know people who have never used an ATM at the bank. And I know people who are in their 80s who email me, actually, on a regular basis. So I think it's an individualistic thing. But I think that I do not like the camera surveillance, and you can get that. And by the way, you can set up systems that will have Skype so that you can interact with somebody just like they're watching a television set, which they're used to. But I think you can do this mapping thing by a plug-and-play technology that is very inobtrusive. And it just, you know, feeds information back. In the same way that they have physical monitors, you know, that you can wear as a wristband, and you can monitor your pulse and your blood pressure and other things about what you're doing. I mean, and when you're in a nursing home care, I mean, the bottom line is they also use technology, and you really don't get an enormous amount of personal care unless you can afford to have somebody sit with you. You know, there's another thing which I think is becoming more popular as the time goes on, and that is to get some seniors who need to supplement their income to become senior caregiver for older seniors. Because it's not a taxing physical job, and I know we have seniors caring for seniors here, and it's allowing people who are in their 70s who need to supplement their income to spend a few hours a day with an older senior who needs that attention and that care, and it's a win-win.
Now, we've been talking about older people. By older, I mean maybe 80s and above, being concerned about losing their privacy. If you are a baby boomer and your parent is living in your home, might you find it hard to have someone come into that home? Might you find it hard to accept the idea of, hey, I need help, I can't tackle this by myself? Don't a lot of caregivers find that disconcerting?
I would think that they do. I mean, and I've known some that, you know, have really resented having a third party come into their home. But it's always difficult to make an adjustment to have an older parent to age in your home. And I think that particularly if you're out, so it's kind of a respite care. And I think boomers are less guarded with their privacy. I think the boom generation has been more open and out there than the generation before them, used to technology, used to posting everything, used to doing things, you know, in a kind of public way. So I think they're less guarded of some of these things than the generation that's before them.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell us a little bit about your group. How did it get formed?
Didn't want to retire. I did not retire, and I was looking to supplement the work that I do typically with something that was more meaningful. So many years ago, I started an online social network for women over 50, and as we were holding conferences on that, I found that caregiving was one of their major issues. So I really started getting interested, and I have had an aging family myself, and then suddenly I realized that I was beginning to have to make my own decisions about aging in place. So that's how I got together people from various disciplines to begin to talk about what aging in place meant to us. So, you know, there's an architect and a psychologist and a couple of ministers and some foundation directors, and we're trying to make our community more aware of what they have to do to support the population that is aging in place. So that's how it's not an easy list, but that's how we got started.
Now, what are some of the services your organization provides?
We are a facilitator and a conversation starter, and so we do conferences, and we work with organizations to try to get them to collaborate with each other. A lot of social service providers really operate in silos where they do their thing funded by whoever funds their issue, and they don't work with each other. So the Community Center for Aging in Place tries to bring multiple agencies together to collaborate on projects and to make a difference and speak in a joint voice to the community. This year, for the first time, our United Way offered a $1 million grant for aging programs. You know, aging programs are not as well funded as one might think because aging just isn't sexy enough. So we really do need to make people more aware of the enormous number of people who are about to come in the system.
Now, you just indicated something very honest. Aging is probably not something most people want to think about. How has the work you've done led you to view aging differently? Or has it?
Oh, it absolutely has. We did our first conference last year in the fall, and I was amazed that we had, half of our speakers were over 70, and these are people of experience and wisdom, and they were interesting, and, and we really have an awful lot of experience. And when, there's a certain liberation about getting to be a certain age because you're beyond the point of really knowing that your life is going to change dramatically, so you kind of accept where you are. And I started out my welcome with, my name is Suzanne Kaplan, and I am a senior citizen. And the minute you say that to somebody, the first time, they look at you differently. And then when you start to own that and decide that's really a badge of honor, it's amazing how empowering that becomes.
That's a very fascinating idea. You are describing this almost like somebody saying with AA, I have this addiction. You're saying point blank something that's been almost shamed. You're coming right out and saying it and saying there's some benefits to it. That must be very empowering.
Well, and there's a second side of it. Number one, as I told this audience, this is not voluntary. This is something that happens to all of us. And frankly, it's the third act of our lives. And, we're no longer young people who don't know what we want to be, and we're no longer middle-aged people who are rushing to complete things and build things. And in that stage, we're at a stage where we can do things that are more meaningful to us. And I think it's starting to become, Jane Pauley has done a whole series now about this third act and what you do. And so I think with some good role models in this, I think we really will make a difference. And I think the more you allow older people to be proud of themselves, the more independent they can and want to be, which I find very interesting.
Now, again, if people don't like to talk about aging, there's one thing they really don't like to talk about, somebody running out of money as they age. Running out of money and power, these things don't seem to come together. Wouldn't you have to have some resources to be able to say, hey, I am doing what I want in this third part of my life and doing things I never had a chance to do before? Wouldn't you have to have some resources to be able to make a statement of that kind?
Well, your best resource is you. And so if you want to do what you want to do, you might be able to do it for money. And that may really help you supplement whatever, retirement income you have. There is clearly a problem with the boomer generation as they're beginning to retire. At this point, 36% of people going into retirement are going in with less than $1,000 in savings. So I think there is a struggle, and there certainly is a wide continuum of how people approach retirement. But I think doing what you want to do might be a way to supplement what you can do. And you don't have to buy entertainment. You can create some projects that you really are engaged in. So, there really is an opportunity here for us to share a good experience that benefits all of us.
Now, when you cite that statistic about the number of people going into retirement, don't have even $1,000 saved, I wouldn't say that's startling, nor is it surprising, but it's very significant because retirement these days can be 10 years longer than it was even when I was growing up.
That, listen, people are outliving their money. And in many ways, it also depends on what, and I do financial things in my day job, and so we call it a burn rate. So it depends on what your burn rate was going into retirement. If you had very little money, then you didn't have a high burn rate. I know people that had a lot of money in their active working career and have a high burn rate, depending on an illness, depending on what level of care you demand. And they're burning through money at almost the same rate that the people that don't have any, which is a percentage of their money. But the interesting thing is that at this point, National Council on Aging reports that over 90% of people 70 and older believe that they are going to be able to age in place. And, you know, nursing homes and assisted living centers are really not that old. I mean, they became a part of the landscape in the 80s, and we as the boomers were kind of the first generation that saw people go into them. And I don't think that's what we want for ourselves. So I think we need to change the meme of how we think of it so that we can allow it to happen for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, if somebody would like to get in contact with you and your organization, how can they do that? Through your website, or how can they do that?
They can write to me it's Suzanne@cc-aip.com, and I'd be glad to answer any inquiries. And we are in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we'd be happy to refer people to co-housing organizations that we've gotten in contact with, some of the research and white papers we've been doing, and we really would like to see a cohesive movement in this direction for all of us.
Now, I understand you're going to be having a major conference in the fall. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
We our first conference was called our Discovery Conference, and the second one is described as the Conversation Continues, and we bring private and public providers together and talk about the way things are changing, keeping solving, keeping social, which is about senior jobs and senior opportunities for work. And housing changes in the co-housing. There are some women in Pittsburgh who wrote a book called My House, Our House, who bought a house together and now are buying an apartment together in Florida and modifying it to age in place, and what their agreements are, and about speaking to, how do you speak to elderly parents to define what their wishes are and how you hold a conversation. So we're going to continue that conversation and invite public officials. We had the President of the United Way and the head of three of the agencies on aging in three counties around us to come and let them see what we're talking about so they can join in the conversation. And that'll be in October in Pittsburgh.
I hope all my listeners will turn to my website to get more information about aging, htramer.com, and you'll find much helpful information there. Thank you for listening, and hope you will listen again 2 weeks from today. Thank you. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
You deal with internet security. What does that term define or mean? Security is to protect somebody against something. What are you trying to protect people against on the internet? I turn on the internet, it's there. What do I need to be protected against, I or anybody else?
A myriad of forms of danger. When you turn on your computer and you connect to the internet, a lot of things happen that most people don't understand, that most people don't know occur. When you turn on the internet, what you're really doing is starting a program on your computer called a browser that figures out where it is you're trying to go, puts all the information into little bags called packets, addresses them to something called a domain name server, sends the packets to another computer elsewhere. That computer determines what the real address is, because all real internet addresses are four groups of three numbers. Determines what the real address is, readdresses all those little bags or packets, sends them to another computer that the information you requested resides on. That computer determines what that information is at the address and sends it back in more little packets to your computer through your internet service provider, through your local network, through all the boxes on your desk, back into your computer, and then that program, the browser, decodes what information was sent and shows you what you actually look at. Now, if you take a look at that, that's information passing through many, many hands under the best circumstances. And the way we all use computers today, our information needs to be protected. Whether you use a program on your computer to do your taxes, or you communicate with your bank over the internet, or financial and investment decisions are made and achieved over the internet. It could be some information that you prefer remained simply between you and whoever you sent it to. There are so many different kinds of information, because we use the computer for so many different things, that that information remains in traces in all of those little places along the way that it has to travel to go back and forth.
Okay, now, to make sure I understand and try to put this in layman's terms, what you're saying is, if I go to my browser being Mozilla Firefox or Chrome,
I
click on my browser, and my browser comes up.
Right.
And I type in blank, 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 the name of the website I want. The website does not just come up. This goes through a series of processes, series of stages. Information passes through these stages. And as it passes through these stages...
And you have no control over where that information goes once it's out on the internet. Part of those packets or little bags of information may go through one series of computers. Other parts are going to go through other series of computers. But you really don't have any control over where that information goes once it's out of your computer or on its way back to your
To be polite, but a little blunt, most people aren't even aware of what you're saying. They think I type in my web address, my URL, comes up.
Well, that URL isn't really the address of the website. No, most people don't know that. I'm sure that's true. For the same reason that most people call anything bad that gets into your computer a virus, although there is a specific type of bad or malicious program, which is a term we use to cover all the bad types of software, malware, malicious software. One type of that is a virus. But that is traditionally a computer program that inserts parts of itself into many, many other files on your computer so that it can reinfect when you run them, or if you send them to someone else and they open a document, they can get the infection, that kind of thing. But there are many, many other categories.
Okay. Now, what I am not at all understanding is why... These viruses that you're discussing are, I assume, inserted by somebody.
Well, yes, they are. And
they don't just happen. Like, my body doesn't just get a virus. It came from somewhere.
Well, correct. Although in nature, there's a debate about where they come from in computers. That is code that is written by someone specifically to do whatever it is that it's doing to your computer, whether that's good or bad. But it's
okay, I believe you, but what I'm not at all understanding I take myself as an example. I get up every morning and go to the New York Times website. Why would anybody care about that? Why would anybody want to mess with my computer to prevent it from functioning properly? What's in it for them? Why would they care?
Just one example, just one way that that occurs is that very many reputable websites of the same caliber and reputation as the New York Times are infected with malware that's put there by someone who has figured out how to get into the computer that that information resides on and insert through various methods that mall or malicious code into the information that returns to your computer. Now, why is almost exclusively money, as with everything else in the world. The malware economy right now is somewhere in the range of $12 billion a year. If someone puts a program on your computer that at the more benign end of things simply pops up ads for things that you don't have any interest in, or perhaps pornography or whatever else it may be, they get paid a very small amount for having that happen on your computer.
Paid by whom?
Well, in that case, it would be the person that wanted to show you those ads, or a company that wanted to show you those ads.
Mm-hmm.
They get paid somewhere in the range of 13 to 85 cents per computer, depending on what they put in. And they go up the scale from there. They may insert a program on your computer that will then download or bring from other computers on the Internet many other types of malicious programs. Some of those programs give people the ability to use your computer as though they were sitting in front of it. They have all the same abilities that you have.
Now, wait a minute. If I'm sitting here by my computer and I go to financial information, I go to my bank or brokerage or whatever, they can watch what I'm doing and find out all my information?
Well, by putting a host of different kinds of software on your computer without your knowledge, yes. Usually when you go to the bank, you have an automatic encrypted connection between your computer and their computer. That varies on type of encryption and type of design of the system. But what you look for would be a lock, sometimes depending on the browser, or the address will be, rather than HTTP colon, it will have an S, HTTPS colon. And that means it's a secure connection in that that information is coded, scrambled, encrypted between your computer and the computer that you're sending it to. Well, that prevents
encrypted means nobody can break in.
Well, it means it would take a lot longer. Encryption is not perfect either. But should they intercept it, it would take them some time to figure out even whether it was worth decrypting. But that only covers the small part of that journey we talked about between your computer and the bank's computer. What happens once it hits the bank's network, or what happens on your computer before it is actually encrypted and sent. As an example, there's a category called keyloggers. Some of those are physical, but most of those are software, and they sit in the background quietly watching everything you type, and when they get the idea that you're heading for a financial service, a website that's on their list, or perhaps certain behaviors, certain triggers, they will be able to intercept whatever you enter into your computer and send it to someone you don't want to have it, before it's ever encrypted and sent back and forth. So there are many, many. That's really the point of explaining how many different steps there are in this process, because there are so many ways and so many places that someone can intercept that information. I've heard from many people, I don't do anything on my computer except once in a while banking, or once in a while I'll buy something. All you have to do is go to a page on the internet, then you are risking whatever information is available about you. Now, we certainly are nowhere near as private a society as we once were, but I think most of us would still prefer that our information remained our information, and we decided who got it, not someone else. Identity theft is a huge problem in the United States these days, probably around the world. The way that occurs is through malicious software. Someone gets the details of your life and makes use of those details to commit crimes in your name.
Okay, let me understand. If I go to my brokerage, in the process of my getting the information, somebody else can commandeer that information and pass it along to someone who has some malicious intent.
Correct. As a matter of fact, those things are very often collected and sold. Credit card numbers, well, many are stolen from the stores themselves through their computer systems, are also routinely stolen from computers that someone has put a program into that isn't. You know, today's malicious software is written much better than it used to be, and computers are much more powerful than they used to be. So you can have an enormous amount of malicious software running in the background that you don't even see. That's akin to five or six burglars sitting outside your window, listening to what you say as you order something over the phone and writing it down. There is, in these times, very little that doesn't get eventually put into a computer.
Now, how would you respond if I or somebody else came to you and says, Scott, you know what you're talking about. This is disconcerting to me. I'm not using my computer. How would you respond to that? I'm closing the thing down.
That is the only way possible to attain 100% computer security. Only slightly better is never attaching it to the internet. Because that computer, whether you're sending information back and forth intentionally or not, is constantly sending information back and forth, maintaining the connection, software sending information back to its manufacturer for many legitimate reasons. But mixed in with all of that can be communications you probably wish weren't occurring. The only flaw in that approach is that you're back to the Stone Age. You now have to go everywhere to do everything in person, and I can tell you that that's a fading ability. That businesses, financial institutions, every kind of commerce is geared in some way towards being accessed over the internet, and will continue to be more and more so. It's one of the reasons that large retailers are failing.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons that JCPenney is having trouble and Barnes & Noble is having trouble. You know, Sears, stalwarts of the past view of commerce, are failing miserably in brick-and-mortar, real-life stores because so much occurs over the internet. I don't know that it's actually possible to have enough time these days to try and conduct all your business without a computer. As a matter of fact, you can't even apply for jobs in many places without a computer. Now you can go to the library and wait in line and get your 15 minutes on the computer and hope to get everything done, but that doesn't seem terribly convenient, and you are now again using your computer attached to the internet. You don't know what the state of security is on that computer.
In other words, if I go to the library and I put in information, how do I know that that's any more secure than if I do it in my own place?
Correct, with the caveat that whoever is administering that computer system likely has more understanding of what's occurring and has taken some steps to try and mitigate the damage available to the hackers and malicious software makers and so forth. But other than that, generally what happens in a library is that they set a baseline a set of software and settings and everything. Every day when they turn off the computer and turn the computer back on, it goes back to the state it was in yesterday. Most of them will do that every time they're restarted. So if you want to be more secure, then again, more is a relative term. We'll be more secure by restarting the computer, going back to a baseline. That will prevent anything that was installed by the previous user, either knowingly or inadvertently. But that still puts us at the mercy of whoever designed that baseline system. Were they 100% correct when they thought it was clean and safe and there was no malware?
In other words, if
there are instances of malware coming on brand new computers from manufacturers.
Wow. If I completely turn off my computer, it goes back to the baseline?
Not yours, but at the library. That takes special software and special stuff.
Okay. What if I run a cookie?
Well, cookies are probably the lowest possible level of concern.
Cookie cleaner.
It is possible. Yes, well, cookies are really a text file, much like if you were to make yourself a note on your computer in a text document, that are allowed to be placed on your computer, depending on the settings of your browser and other software and so forth. The majority of their information is designed to make your experience more convenient on the internet, though they'll keep track of what pages you visited in their site. They'll keep track of your login and that sort of thing. Credentials, generally not the password, but all the rest of the things that when you show up are automatically there for you. There is some possibility to use a malicious approach to grab cookies from a different site. You know, you visit site A and it puts a cookie on your system, and then you visit site B, and site B is not supposed to be able to do this, but there are techniques available to not only put a cookie on your computer from site B, but grab the cookie that was on the computer from site A. So there is some possible leakage there, but it is, of the categories of threats available, probably the lowest level. Tracking cookies are things that some people are very unhappy with, and understandably. That would be a leak of information you probably would prefer didn't happen, but it's done legally by corporations, giant corporations. Google just bought a while back a company called DoubleClick, who had one of the worst reputations and still pretty much performs the same way in tracking your every move from one site to another in your search terms and so forth. That's how, when you search for, say, saddle, you are then shown ads almost immediately on other pages, on other sites, in other places for saddlery. Many people have had that experience, and if you look closely, you'll see it happen at least once or twice a day, depending on the state of your computer and so forth. So tracking cookies really are the least malicious of the unwanted types of software and the unwanted leaks of your information.
What I've experienced, like you said, I have gone to a certain site, then I'm searching elsewhere on the web, an ad for that site comes up. That is because of the process you just mentioned?
Correct. They're tracking you.
Now, is that malicious? Can that harm me? Or is that just a fact of life?
Well, it kind of depends on your desire for privacy. It's not liable to cause you any problem unless somebody intercepts it. You, again, remember all the steps. There's no guarantee that only you and the company that's trying to read your tracking information are the ones doing so. The information
now
remains on your computer, so somebody else can find it.
What are some other hints or some good guidelines for security on the web? What you're describing, nothing is perfect, but what are some ideas I should follow to give myself the best chance of of security. Now,
well, the standard toolkit and the standard recommendations that are unfortunately more complex than most people understand, should they even attempt to understand what to do to secure their computer. You know, the absolute best answer to that, unless you are able to spend an hour and a half or 2 hours a day researching the latest evaluations of available software tools for the detection and removal. If you spend that time determining what the newest threats and newest methods of messing with your computer information and life are, then doing it on your own is simply installing a credible antivirus. And there are free ones that are just as good as paid-for applications. But then you need to know how to configure it, and you need to know what all those different scans and so forth do, which is sometimes difficult. Most people think you install it and forget it. And you can to an extent, but nothing, as we said, is perfect. You will also need an anti-spyware or anti-malware program. And antiviruses do catch things in other categories besides virus, but nothing out there is designed to catch everything. And if it were, it would be probably so huge you wouldn't want it on your computer. So then you need a second scanner. And you need these scanners to be running full-time in the background constantly, examining what you read and write on your computer, what files are read and written to the hard drive and into random access memory and so forth. And you're also going to want to do probably a scan every so often, independently. And an important note here is that you cannot run true antivirus programs at the same time. Your computer will not be able to stand it. The two will conflict, and that won't work. So you have to be careful about what combination of software you do put into your computer. You're also going to need a firewall. Firewalls come basically with all Windows systems these days. There's some debate about whether they're the most effective or not. And obviously, there are improvements that can be made with an independent firewall. But basically, that keeps people from sending bags of information, packets, to your computer that your computer didn't ask for. That is designed to prevent people from connecting to your computer without your permission or understanding, without your knowledge. That is hacking. That's pretty much what we call hacking. That it would be where someone tries to find a way to get into your computer. Now, that can be done either through Windows operating system or any one of dozens of other subsets of software that run in the background that you're unaware of that are used to make up what you're looking at on that one page on your screen. I would probably suggest some kind of software to minimize the pop-ups and to be careful of tracking cookies, just because that's pretty simple to do. Sometimes you can do that with changing the settings and so forth in the security area of your browser. But that's another point. Settings within your computer change almost daily. And if some setting is changed either maliciously or by some form of error, that now opens up a door for somebody to get into your computer, that can be a problem. And the settings that come as default for browsers aren't necessarily the most secure. So there is some work to be done within the software itself that's a little bit much for the, at-home computer, average computer user. I would also suggest some things that give you some form of understanding the reputation of what link you're about to click. There are also programs that you can install that will simply prevent your computer from going to, the one I use at last check had something like 187,000 addresses of known bad sites that were going to infect your computer that it just won't allow your computer to go to. So there are many, approaches. But you are going to be the best security tool your computer will ever have. And by that, I mean you have to be careful of what you click and where you go, and consider that you have to be mindful that people are trying to harm you. Try to avoid that. Don't open email attachments from unknown sources, or in some cases from known sources. If you got a document you didn't expect, and these people rarely send you a document, you may want to investigate whether they actually sent you that or not. It's entirely possible to pretend to be someone that the malicious actor is not. Documents. You have to be very careful about opening documents. There is a way to open a Word document, as an example, in something called safe mode of Word, which prevents most of the popular attacks from actually working. But then other parts of the document that are commonly used, macros and things of that nature, which are programs within the document, won't run correctly. So, you know, it's a trade-off. It's always a balance of what's the best thing for your computer. But at bare minimum, an antivirus, a firewall, and an anti-malware program. Another suggestion would be, if it's something that you really have some concern about, would be to involve a professional. You know, where you find that professional and what experience they have and so forth will vary greatly, and so will the costs involved. If you were to, say, go to a big box electronics store, you're going to pay considerably more than you would for someone who has their own business. Overhead is low, and they really are able to provide better value to them. But if you're going to do it on your own, there's a lot to learn. I get a report once a week from the Computer Emergency Response Team, CERT, out of Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, that lists, you know, at least a couple of times a week, hundreds of new vulnerabilities that have been discovered. Thousands of new viruses and malicious programs are written every day. This is 24 hours a day around the planet. Someone in India may write one type of malware that you find in your computer, and somebody in Ukraine may have bought it from him and used it to get into your computer. It's a very, very large number of people attempting to get some of the money in that malware account.
Now, our older people, we talk about aging on this show, are they particularly vulnerable, or does age have nothing to do with this?
Well, physical age doesn't. Mental age and attitude towards technology does play a big part. I have some elderly clients, some of whom are very competent with their computer. They may not understand quite everything that that I do about a computer, but they understand much more than some people I've met who are much younger than that. It really depends. If someone's willing to understand that this is something new, a new category, something completely different than they're able to draw from in their experience, we have a good chance to educate. But many people look at it as though it's an appliance, a refrigerator, a television, things of that nature, where it's just on or off, and it doesn't do anything except get the signal from the antenna and show it to you, or, you know, keep your food cold or something of that sort. And even those things are changing. We're heading towards something called the Internet of Things, where all things will be connected to the Internet. Your refrigerator will tell you when your milk went bad on your phone.
Scott, thank you very much for being a guest on the show. And I'm sure you have very greatly informed all our listeners. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope it was useful. I'd like to think everybody can learn to do this if they put in enough time and effort. But, lessons, information, resources, all important. And, you know, some of this information, if you study hard enough, is available on the internet. Thanks for having me on. I hope everybody stays safe.